Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today, we'll hear a recent talk given by Peter Dale Scott, who was in conversation with David Talbot. The title of the talk was Exposing the CIA, the Secret Government's War on Democracy. And here is Peter to introduce Peter Dale Scott.
Peter Dale Scott served in Canada's diplomatic corps and later taught literature at the University of California. He's a prolific author on political history, specializing in what he calls the deep state, the unelected government that exists beneath the official one. He has written about the JFK assassination, the September 11th attacks, and many other issues. His latest book is The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. Scott was joined on stage by fellow author David Talbot. Talbot has a new book out as well, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, and the Rise of American Secret Government. Now let's hear that conversation.
David Talbot and Peter Dale Scott. Thank you all for coming out tonight, and thank you to the unparalleled Patrick Marks of Green Arcade. I'm going to start with a few remarks. It's a testament to Peter Dale Scott, so don't blush, Peter. But I want to share some of my thoughts about Peter before we begin. And then we're going to get into a dialogue, and it's going to be focused largely on his new book, which I think is very important and in some ways is a synthesis of much of Peter's work over the past few years. So these are my prepared remarks. Power. It's a sexy subject in America. Vanity Fair does its annual list of the most powerful people in the country, the so-called new establishment. Forbes magazine does its rankings of the wealthiest people in the country. But few journalists or scholars have made it their mission to analyze the true realities of power in America, at least not since the pioneering work done by Columbia University sociologist and self-proclaimed anarchist C. Wright Mills, author of The Power Elite, back in the 1950s. In recent years, it took a former Canadian diplomat, UC Berkeley literature professor, and poet named Peter Dale Scott to undertake the most profound scrutiny of American power, from the Cold War era to the War on Terror. It was Scott who developed the notion of deep politics back in the early 1990s. The insight that America is ruled by a parallel system of power that operates above and in some ways below our democratic system of governance. This evening we'll be discussing Peter's interpretation of the monumental deep events that have changed the course of recent history and tragically deformed our grand American experiment. These deep events have brought us to a juncture where, in the words of Jimmy Carter, the rest of the world almost unanimously looks at America as the number one warmonger, end quote. And as Peter observes in his new book, this permanent state of war that the United States has imposed on the world since World War II has in turn dangerously militarized our own society. Now, to an unprecedented extent, he writes, America itself is being treated by those in authority as an occupied territory. Fundamental principles of American society, such as respect for civil liberties and the rule of international law, are being jettisoned, Peter writes, because of a so-called terrorist threat that is largely of America's own making. The war on terror has become an endless, self-generating conflict that creates more enemies than it eliminates. And now, today, we have President Obama demanding yet more executive authority to widen this war without end. But despite the grim situation we find ourselves in, as Imperial America plows its way into a second century, Peter, being Peter, remains more a prophet of hope than one of doom. He notes that in his book that he has seen during his lifetime the way that popular movements and visionary leaders have brought nations and peoples back from the brink of destruction and have chosen life and liberty over death and subjugation. I want to welcome Peter Dale Scott, author of the important new book, The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. P- Peter, on behalf of our wonderful host, Patrick Marks of Green Arcade, an oasis, by the way, of literary and political culture in the belly of the corporate digital beast. I want to say what a pleasure it is to speak with you this evening, Peter.
David, didn't you realize that after all that, anything I say is going to be an anticlimax?
I think you'll hold up quite well, Peter. Well, let's start with the obvious. How do you define the deep state?
The deep state actually is a phrase I used back in 2007 for America. It was originally used about Turkey. And then it went sort of viral last year. And on the Bill Moyers show, somebody called Mike Lofgren, whose background, by the way, is Republican, he came up with a very good definition, which I will read because it's something that he and I share. And then I will make my own issues with it, but it's a good starting point. It's page 11, and it says, this is Mike Lofgren on the Bill Moyers show. There is the visible government situated around the mall in Washington, and then there is another, more shadowy, more indefinable government that is not explained in Civics 101 or observable to tourists at the White House or the Capitol. The former is traditional Washington partisan politics, the tip of the iceberg that a public watching C-SPAN sees daily and which is theoretically controllable via elections. The subsurface part of the iceberg I shall call the deep state, which operates according to its own compass heading, regardless of who is formerly in power. And that's the really important thing, that we go back and forth, Republican, Democrat, and so on, but the really deadly programs don't change. I mean, the drones started under Bush. The drones are bigger, and we're going to come back to the drones, but the real scandal about the drones is we had a Republican president, Ford, who said by executive order that America does not assassinate, period.
Back in the 1970s.
That was back in 1975, and it was to actually very interesting. It was to stave off the Church Committee investigation of the CIA. They were trying to stop things from going too far. And now we have a Democratic president who just signs off on killing people without any judicial process whatsoever. And the wrong people repeatedly are getting killed. Or even at one famous time, they got the man they wanted, but he was negotiating with one of the most moderate leaders in Yemen, and the two of them, of course, got killed. So I think it's a very high priority to end this drone. If anything, it symbolizes for the rest of the world that America has a killer culture, and we do. And, of course, it goes back to the Indians and everything, but now it's focused on this issue of drones, and somehow we have to get that to stop.
Well, let's talk about the...
Oh, no, can yeah, I, sure, I'm not finished. The trouble with... I know I mustn't go on too long, but the trouble with the iceberg metaphor, it's a very good metaphor, but it suggests that everything down there is solid, just like everything up on top is solid. And that's where I brought in the statement that what's down below is not a structure. To some part, it's a composite of structures, but it is so incredibly vaster that it's better to think of it as a system like a weather system. And there are various layers. Another metaphor is an onion. You know, the top layer of the onion is the government and the Constitution. The next layer is the CIA and the NSA and now JSOC in the Pentagon, which is perhaps more sinister even than the CIA. And then you get another layer in my book, which is these private consulting companies, like I can say quite a lot about Booz Allen Hamilton, ostensibly a private company, but internationally they've been very in sync since 1953 when both of them started operating in the same countries. It was interesting that CIA went in to overthrow the government in Iran, and there was Booz Allen Hamilton. They developed a close relationship with Nasser. It was really done mostly through Booz Allen Hamilton. So these are private companies that are part of the power structure. And then we're on our way to the corporations and the banks that Booz Allen also do their business with. And then finally you come to Wall Street and the bankers. And I do have a quote here from Franklin Roosevelt in 1933, talking to his friend Colonel House, saying that you and I know, this is his words, that a financial element has controlled this country since the age of Jackson. And the only thing wrong with that quote is he didn't go far enough back.
Well, so going back then to sort of the recent origins and recent history of what you call the deep state, it really did seem to go into hyperdrive under Eisenhower. When the Republicans finally took power in Washington after long Democratic rule, and it really has its roots in some way in the nuclear age, because as you write about, you call it the Doomsday Project. There was, in many ways, an understandable effort by the part of the federal government in the case of a nuclear attack to set up a shadow government or a government that would survive the nuclear assault. It's kind of satirized, in fact, in Dr. Strangelove, the film, which Dan Ellsberg, I know, has referred to as a documentary. And having worked with some of the nuclear madmen himself, he's in a good position to describe it that way. But in any case, the Doomsday Project, Peter, what exactly was the Doomsday Project?
Well, first of all, it's not my phrase. It's the Pentagon's phrase for continuity of government planning. They faced the fact that there was a risk, a legitimate concern about a nuclear war in which the government would be decapitated. And the succession for who runs the country would no longer apply if the top five or six people had all been killed at the same time. So you started this COG planning, and they called it the Doomsday Plan. And by the way, on the cover of the book, I have a dramatic over-representation of what actually happened on 9/11. You have the White House here, and flying over the White House in airspace which is never supposed to be entered by any plane, you had what the Pentagon calls the Doomsday Plane, which is the seat of government in a B-747 that would continue to run the country if everything on the ground had been annihilated. And they developed, at a cost of more than $8 billion, a whole second communications network to be in touch with that doomsday plane. And most of you probably know they hollowed out mountains around Washington. How many people did not know that there's place for a secret government inside a mountain near Washington?
Is this Dick Cheney's undisclosed
location?
So most people know that, but not many people know that as soon as President Bush was back in Washington on 9/11, because one of the rules of COG is that in a crisis, the president and the vice president separate. So Cheney went off not alone, but with about 100 bureaucrats and lived inside a mountain for the next 90 days. And I don't know which was the more important government for those 90 days, the one which was in Washington or the one which was hatching up inside a mountain things like Project Endgame, well, the change in the FISA laws. From the 1980s, it was clear that there were three basic principles to continuity of government planning. And that was warrantless surveillance, which, of course, we all know about now, thanks to Edward Snowden, which we did have a FISA Act, and then it got overridden after 9/11. Warrantless detention. Project Endgame was launched in September of 2001. I can't prove it came from the mountain, but I believe this is just a final codification of what these secret planners on COG have been planning for 20 years.
So the COG process was clearly underway before 9/11. You talk about in the book how the Patriot Act itself had its roots in an earlier time.
Right.
And it was, in some ways, they were all ready to go with the Patriot Act when the trauma happened.
They produced this 300-page act out of nowhere, like the Tonkin Gulf Resolution was produced out of nowhere. There's another case, too, that most people don't know about. When Bobby Kennedy was killed, it took him 24 hours to die, And before he was dead, Congress had passed an act giving all kinds of special powers to the Secret Service that were responsible for a lot of the worst things that happened under Watergate. So this is, in a sense, an old trick. You have a crisis and you whip out something that's ready. And if you didn't know it, there had been a big change in COG planning occurred under Reagan in 1982. Because every administration did it, but it was always for an atomic attack until Reagan. And then, and this was codified in Executive Order 12656, it's now not for an atomic attack, but for any emergency that threatens the security of the United States. 9/11 was such an emergency, and it was implemented. Two reviews of my first book on 9/11 said Scott conjectures that it was implemented. No, it's right there in the 9/11 Commission report that it was implemented, and they have a footnote saying this is continuity of government planning. We did not look into this. They didn't have the clearance to look into it, so there are big gaps.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're listening to a discussion featuring political historian Peter Dale Scott. He spoke in San Francisco on February 11th at an event sponsored by Green Arcade Books. After this musical interlude, we'll return to that conversation. Stay with us.
Peter, in some ways, your work parallels Naomi Klein's thinking in The Shock Doctrine, in which he says that the powers that be are quite ready and able to exploit shocks to the system, whether they're natural disasters or whether they're military assaults like 9/11. One of the things I was most interested in your book, and I had forgotten this, is how the Patriot Act, in some ways, was pushed through Congress because of the panic in Washington that was precipitated by the anthrax letters that were sent, conveniently and coincidentally, to the two Democratic senators, Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy, who were most strongly opposing the Patriot Act.
Right, and were in a position to oppose it because Leahy was the chairman of a committee and Daschle was the leader of the Senate. The theory was that these wild Arab terrorists, I mean, they had fake notes that suggested...
Well, the idea was that they'd been sent by Saddam. Saddam's work. And, of course, they never saw...
Sent them to the opposition, which doesn't make any sense, does it? There was the first theory. There's a very good book out that people should know about and hopefully buy called The Anthrax Deception by Graham McQueen, another Canadian, by the way. And he points out that much like the Kennedy assassination, where in the first hours it was being blamed on Cuba or Russia, so the anthrax was being blamed on Iraq. And he shows the very, very close coordination between the dates that crucial propaganda pieces appeared in the New York Times and the Washington Post. And that was the day that the letters were mailed to the opposition that were trying to block the Patriot Act. Well, then we went from phase one, Iraq did it, to phase two. No, it was a lone nut somewhere in the American biowarfare system. First of all, a man called Stephen Hatfield, and then a man called Bruce Ivins. But this book satisfies me that neither man was in a position to know anything about weaponizing anthrax. This wasn't a crude shipment. This was very sophisticated, weaponized anthrax. And that made good sense if you were going to blame it on Iraq, but it makes no sense at all if you're trying to blame it on Professor Hatfield or Professor Ivins. It was not a one-man job, just as the Kennedy assassination was not a one-man job. So that the anthrax, it's the most blatant example of something being terribly wrong in this deep event. And I'm just amazed that America has been willing to forget about it.
Another one of the stranger threads throughout the 9/11 drama has been the role of the Saudi royal family. And that angle is back in the news again, of course, in the last couple of days. More allegations that the Saudis helped finance 9/11. You have a lot to say about the interesting collusion between the powers in Washington, national security agencies, the oil industry, and the Saudi family. Can you go into that a bit?
Yeah.
How it relates to 9/11?
Well, yes, it's very important in my book. And I do want to make it clear, I do not say that the Saudis financed 9/11. There are people who believe that and are suing for millions of dollars. Let's just begin what was wrong about the war on terror, Bush's war on terror, from the very outset. The three countries that were doing most to back Saudi terrorists were Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and maybe I should say United Arab Emirates, too. They became our chief allies in this supposed war. The chief enemies of these terrorists before they turned on America were Iraq, Gaddafi, and Iran. And somehow these became America's enemies. So we're fighting a war on terror in which we're on the same side as the terrorists. And not much is said about that. Now, to come to this question of financing, it's very important. I'm sure everyone knows there are 28 pages that we may finally get to see from the Joint Congressional Inquiry in 2002. And it's all about Saudi financing going to at least two and probably more of the alleged hijackers, the designated culprits. And I have a great deal to say about this, which is hard to condense. But it seems quite obvious, and we come into the question that the CIA was cognizant of what was going on and was actually protecting these two specific, Al-Midar and Al-Hamzi, these two particular terrorists, one should have been very worried about, and the FBI should have been notified, and the CIA, somebody from the FBI in the CIA tried to notify the FBI, was told he couldn't do it, and then just to make things cover over this scandal, the CIA put out a cable saying that the FBI had been notified when they hadn't. So from all of this, we deduce that the CIA and the Saudis had some kind of joint operation going on, and I can speculate more in detail, but the important thing is they had a joint operation. And this is an analogy with the Kennedy assassination again. The people who designed 9/11, and obviously 9/11, besides the designated culprits, there are real culprits somewhere, and I don't know where exactly, but the real culprits knew about this joint U.S.-Saudi operation and used the names of people in it to be the designated culprits because they were guaranteed that way that this would become a massive deep event which nobody would be able to get to the bottom of.
And perhaps also knew that some of the key plotters, or key figures at least, who were alleged to be part of the 9/11 plot, had their own strange history of connections to the U.S. intelligence agencies. Talk a bit about that, because that's, again, another parallel with the Kennedy assassination. We now know that Lee Harvey Oswald had a long history of contacts with different intelligence agencies before, during.
He had a thick CIA file.
Thick CIA file. They got thicker and thicker as Dallas came closer. And so talk about the parallels there and how, in both cases, actually with Oswald and the hijackers of the planes in 9/11, for some reason, the intelligence spotlight was suddenly turned off them shortly before the event.
That's very important. First of all, in most of my books, my definition of a deep event has been phenomenological. It's something that it happens. We don't know what happened. We know, if we're savvy, we know it's going to be covered up. And that's a phenomenon from outside, looking at how it appears. I'm almost at this point ready to venture an ontological definition, which is a deep event, or what I call a structural deep event that's going to affect the history of America. You're likely to find an ontological link to the intelligence agencies and above all the CIA. And that is the case with Oswald, and it is the case with these two hijackers, alleged hijackers. And now, what you said about turning off the spy is absolutely crucial. If you're going to have a designated culprit like Lee Harvey Oswald, it's very important he not get picked up before the event, because then he won't fill the function. Well, Oswald actually went up, he had been apolitical when he came back to America in 1962 until a few weeks before the assassination. He goes very public, gets himself arrested in a fake event, gets himself on radio and TV in New Orleans, and all of this is recorded. So you'd say, okay, well then the FBI and the CIA are going to get more interested, right? No. He had been on the watch list, and 3 weeks before the assassination, they took him off the watch list.
This is the man who defected, ex-Marine, to the Soviet Union, denouncing his country, saying he was going to give the Soviets military secrets, married a Soviet woman, brought her back to the U.S. unmolested.
Strange. A Soviet woman with an intelligence background herself,
exactly.
Somehow got a visa. So, yes, the designated culprit, Lee Harvey Oswald, was preserved by... Oh, and there was one more thing. The CIA hears from Mexico that he allegedly, I don't believe it, but allegedly had met an officer in the Soviet embassy who was in fact a high KGB agent. And in fact, the CIA started saying almost immediately, an expert on assassinations. Well, wouldn't you tell the FBI? No. The CIA sent a long, long message to the FBI about all this, and they left out the part about Kostikov, the Soviet agent. They obviously didn't want Oswald to be locked up or put under surveillance or anything which would have spoiled his role as a thing. It sounds, and I have to watch myself, it sounds as if I'm saying the CIA did it. But I go back to what I said. There is no single secret team. There is no single guilty agency. There are people who dwell within this huge system, and there is a continuity there, but there are different people in different decades. But what is very striking to me, that every one of these big, deep events we're talking about, you find a rather large role played by people who had access to this alternative doomsday communications.
And again, not to belabor this point, but again, the parallel with 9/11, there were all sorts of alarms. There was, as one person described it, a red blinking light going on.
The system was blinking red. Yes,
that America was about to be attacked, and yet the dogs didn't bark for some reason.
Right, and they didn't have, apparently the system, this multi-billion defense system we have, didn't perform on the day, right. But the really crucial analogy, and I have almost a chapter on this. By the way, there are all kinds of people who were being protected. Terrorists who were protected, maybe Ali Mohammed is one I start with, but there's a series of them.
Well, the Ali Mohammed example is quite, I think, illuminating. So, Peter, why don't you take a little time to explain who Ali Mohammed is and what happened.
If I could just finish that sentence. The protection that the CIA gave to Al-Midar and Al-Hamzi, these two people who entered the country, one of them had a multi-entry visa, and the CIA protected them from FBI investigation. It gets more complicated, but also more active in the weeks just before 9/11, in a way which makes you think that somebody somewhere knew that 9/11 was going to happen, and they're adjusting the record on these two people. But they're two at the end of a series that goes back at least to 1993. Ali Mohammed is a high-level person, very high-level person in Al-Qaeda, somebody who speaks directly to Osama bin Laden, and who arranged, by the way, one of the things he did was arrange for Osama bin Laden to move from Afghanistan to the Sudan. And that might sound like he just went and bought a ticket. No, there were about 170 people and a whole bunch of horses. they needed a plane for the horses.
It was a big operation.
So it was a big operation
to
move
him. Many wives, big family.
And he went up from, he was stationed, he lived not far from us in, I think, Mountain View. And he went up to Vancouver to welcome another terrorist. The other man was eventually convicted of terrorism. And Ali Mohammed went up to Vancouver to bring him back into the United States. So the RCMP detained him. And what Ali Mohammed did when being detained by the RCMP, he pulled out a piece of paper with a phone number on it and said, phone this number and you will release me. And they phoned the number and they did release him. And the number was the number of an agent in the local San Francisco FBI office. Now, this is something that was reported in the Globe and Mail, which is Canada's leading newspaper. You would think it was news, especially if I say that was in early 1993, and later in the same year, he flew to Kenya, and he started planning for the successful bombing of the U.S. embassy in Kenya, which was the first major al-Qaeda operation against the United States. That's how important he was, and that's how serious it is that he was let go by the RCMP when he could have been kept in detention legitimately and imprisoned. Now, that has never been reported in any major newspaper the way it happened.
In America.
In America. It's pathetic to see how the New York Times twisted one way, the Washington Post twisted another way, the Wall Street Journal twisted another way. The only candid account I found in America is from a Pentagon file from Fort Bragg, which is where actually Ali Mohammed was stationed as a member of U.S. Special Forces at the same time that he was a member of al-Qaeda. So why did this happen? Tim Weiner in his book says, oh, well, is it Weiner? Somebody says. The FBI agent in San Francisco was using him as an informant. Well, that happens to be true, but has nothing to do with his being released because Ali Mohammed had been protected a year earlier on the East Coast when, you may remember, the head of the Jewish Defense League, Meir Kahan, was murdered. And immediately one man was picked up, and when they went to his, an Arab, and when they went to this man's home, they found two more, and they found all kinds of files with high security clearances. Files which Ali Mohammed had stolen, taken, maybe he was authorized, I don't know, but anyway, he'd taken them from Fort Bragg. They were now in this home with these two co-conspirators, and immediately they said, we have our man. They actually called him a lone nut, which is evocative for other events. And so they covered up. Ali Mohammed was training people to go to Afghanistan. And this was interesting because at this time, Russia had pulled out of Afghanistan. And the CIA, much to the distaste of the State Department, they had a real battle about this, continued to back terrorists in Afghanistan, even though the Russian enemy was no longer there. And otherwise, it was becoming very unsymmetrical. We weren't matching what the Soviets were doing. Soviets had withdrawn, and we were doing it anyway. And he was being protected in his training. And then when it was over in Afghanistan, they continued to protect him, and there was now people for Bosnia. And it's not known, usually, that America was backing terrorists, Muslim terrorists in Bosnia. We were supposed to be fighting them. There were two factions in Bosnia, two American factions in Bosnia. We were on both sides in that war.
Peter, I want to open it up to questions soon. I want to ask you one more question, though, before we do that, because I know there's going to be some very interesting queries directed at you. But what I want you to get at before we do that is, Because you write on this level too, Peter, not just about the details of this the shadow world, but really what it's done to the soul of America. You write so eloquently about the situation where this strange fluid war of shifting alliances, and we don't know who's on our side from time to time or who we're supposed to be against. But at the end of the day, it seems to be a war that benefits the Saudi dynasty, that benefits sort of militaristic forces in the United States, that benefits Israel, that benefits terror networks in some ways. Yeah. And you compare it to the war on drugs.
Yes.
This self-generating war that goes on and on year after year because it serves the benefit to the benefit of both sides. And what does that? And so if you can comment on that, the strange nature of the self-generating war, and also what ultimately it does to a country like ours, where you have this kind of violence year after year and the kind of repression that goes with it.
But I hope people take seriously the idea that these wars create their own enemies and therefore justify the continuation. It's very obvious to me and to some other people that the American oil companies, when they start drilling and investing tens of millions of dollars in Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, they want to have an American army somewhere nearby so that the local leaders don't just listen to Moscow, they will also listen to Washington. So there is a very clear motive for wanting to get armies there. And when you had the Project for the New American Century, PNAC, with all these neocons like Cheney and Rumsfeld, and they produced this document, and it talked about the need for a forward strategy, putting these armies there. They didn't mention oil. I think it's wonderful that here you have Cheney and Rumsfeld. This, I didn't get to mention this. For 20 years, they were on the secret committee that was planning the Doomsday Project, even when neither of them was in the government. Both of them were chairmen of big corporate CEOs.
The very definition of the deep state.
Yes, yes. So that, but they were planning for the suspension of the American Constitution, even though they weren't even in the government. And they were also publicly signing on to this PNAC document that called secretly for the event, in effect, for what could be implemented by 9/11.
And in the case of Cheney working for the private sector, a military-related company, right, that was going to benefit from this.
Yes, his subsidiary, KBR, became the principal contracting company in Iraq. And
there it's a sweet racket.
So, you know, you listed all those countries. Don't forget America is one of the countries that,
yes,
their corporations and their war industry need this. I think, in a sense, it all goes back to the 70s. In my book, I see the period 1960 to 1980, when we had one president assassinated, another couldn't run for re-election because he had such tension with his generals. The next one got re-elected for a second term, but then had to resign, which is really extraordinary in American politics.
This is Nixon, and you think in part because of some of the intrigues related to the maneuverings.
Right. And I'm not quite finished. And the next two were incumbents who were defeated when they stood for re-election, something that hadn't happened in American history since Herbert Hoover. So it was an unusual period, and what you really see in it, after the end of the Vietnam War, a lot of things changed. And one of them was the CIA came under scrutiny, and you had people in Congress, like Senator Church, who were trying to open it up and have a more open society. And then you secretly also had the CIA, or what I call in the book, I'm quoting someone else, a CIA within the CIA, plotting on what to do about Church and really what to do about Carter, because Carter was part of this whole spirit of getting the CIA out of covert operations. And anyway, in that same crucial period, American corporations started exporting America's manufacturing power and putting it overseas. And we went instead, we were either going to go back to a civilian economy after Vietnam, or we were going to maintain a military economy. And I think that was a serious point of contention in the 1970s, and it was unilaterally decided by the election of Ronald Reagan, who hugely increased the defense budget and did many other things, that we have been in a state of war, effectively, ever since. The Cold War, there was a threat it might stop when the Berlin Wall came on down. What do we get instead? A war on terrorism, and which actually began, the war on terrorism technically began way back in 1980. It was Reagan's campaign. Only he said Moscow is the arch terrorist, and a phony book came out.
Claire Sterling's
book. It's a junk book, but when Casey came in as new director of the CIA, he went to all these pros and CIA analysts of the Soviet thing and plunked the book down on their desk and said, you have to write about this from now on. And they refused, and their reports were then rewritten by little political bohunks who came in. And then they said at the end of the decade, we didn't know the end of the Soviet Union was coming. That's because they destroyed the brains of the CIA. You mustn't think that all CIA are covert operatives. There is an intelligence side. There may be not.
Political side. And just a final comment, I mean, you do go to great lengths to not overly personalize the deep state, and yet there are these fascinating individual characters that do keep popping up in these stories. William Casey, one, CIA director. Alan Dulles, of course, who I write about in my new book. Rumsfeld, Cheney. It does need these kind of sinister characters on some level for it to work, and very effective at what they do.
Yes. George Bush, the senior George Bush, I think, should be put in that category. He went into the CIA in 1976 to pave the way for something called Team B, which was the first effort to override the professionals in the CIA with a second estimate of the Soviet threat that would justify all.
And it undercut Carter. I mean, getting rid of Carter was, I think, a pivotal moment. I would say that the Kennedy assassination, Reagan's triumph, and 9/11 were the three, I think, deep events in my lifetime that did the most damage to this country.
And I agree.
And the run-up to Carter's defeat, and you write about this, the October surprise, in which basically William Casey cut a deal with the Iranians in Paris.
That's part of it. But also what is not often looked at critically enough was the great oil price hike of that period, which was blamed on the Iranian Revolution and the shortage of oil. I just read in a very good book yesterday how suddenly there was no more Iranian oil. Not true. Actually, the American oil companies imported more oil in the middle of that great crisis than they had in the previous years. So why did the price go way up in America? Why were people queued up? Those of you who remember, you know, some people had to wait.
Well, it was the gas lines and the Iranian hostage crisis that killed Carter.
The two of them together. The reason that there was no gas was because the American oil companies, knowing that there was this huge crisis in America, were selling the oil abroad because they could get more money for it in Europe. And I don't think that was a purely economic decision, just like I don't think the recent drop in oil prices is it's partly economic, but it's not purely economic. It is partly political. When Saudi Arabia and the CIA agree on getting a common enemy, which happens to be Putin right now, then they manipulate the price of oil.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips with Mickey Huff. We're listening to a conversation between authors Peter Dale Scott and David Talbert, recorded on February 11th in San Francisco. After this short musical break, we'll hear part of the audience question and answer period.
Yes, start right here.
I have two different questions, completely unrelated. The first one is simple. I wonder if you've given any thought to a man named Jerome Hauer as an operative within what you call the deep state. He has so many interesting things on his resume that relate in different ways to 9/11 and anthrax and Cipro and World Trade Center 7 that I find him a fascinating individual. And the second and completely unrelated question is, One of the things that I find most disheartening and frightening is the impact over decades on the public mind and the character of Americans.
Well, yes, actually, I'm going to, in my next book, try to write about just that issue. Let me say, unlike many critics of America, I believe that the American Revolution, for all its faults, I know that there's now a very interesting theory that it was really succeeded because the American ruling class knew that Britain was about to emancipate slaves and make slavery illegal. And because it was the basis of the economy, not just in the South, but also in the North, they wanted to have a revolution. That may be true. I think it is true. And yet it was still a great step forward in the world, the American Revolution, the idea that people can shape their own government. And it was an inspiration to Europe. You got the whole Young Europe movement and the revolution of 1848. And eventually, you can say the United Europe that you see today, which has put an end to these senseless wars between France and Germany, all of that inspired by the American Revolution. So I'm an exceptionalist about the revolution, but the exceptionalism today, America's exceptional. We have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners. So we have more prisoners under lock and key than any other developed nation. So we're now exceptional in the reverse direction. And it comes back to what you were talking about, that people are being conditioned. And believe the CIA from the very beginning, they took a great interest in what they call psychological warfare, which is how to condition people to accept things. And under their charter, they could do it for people abroad, but some of the people that they trained turned around and did it domestically. And, the whole, what's happened to newspapers, the Washington Times, for example, has become an American newspaper that was founded officially by the Moonies, but probably really by the Korean Central Intelligence Agency, that's the South Korean Central Intelligence Agency, with the encouragement of people in the deep state in Washington. So that makes the reactionary spoutings from the New York Times and the Washington Post look like centrists when compared to the Washington Times. So that is going on.
All right, let's get another question.
Yes, I wanted to know in terms of the origins of the modern American deep state, if you could speak to what forces shaped so quickly after World War II the creation of the National Security State, the consolidation of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the creation of the CIA, including allowing it to have covert activities as opposed to just analysis, which was one of the main. But all these things happened very quickly after World War II. 1947, National Security.
Yeah.
And so, to me, it happened so quickly. It means that during World War II, American elites were preparing this apparatus at the same time where the Soviet Union is our ally. It's tearing up the guts of the major part of the German army because most of the heavy divisions were on the Eastern Front. So right in the middle of a war where we're allies with the Soviet Union, we're preparing to unleash this national security state in the Cold War.
You put your finger right on it, and that's the
book.
Subject of my book.
That's his
book. Alan Dulles, but Peter has a lot to say about that.
Well, first of all, I could quibble on some of the things you said, but basically I agree with you. But I do not think that what emerged at that time was the deep state. The deep state, to go back to what Roosevelt said, has been around, I would say, since before the Revolution, and was helped arrange for the American Revolution. But yes, there was no secret about it that the Council on Foreign Relations, which is one of the aspects of the deep state, they had their war peace studies going on through World War II. Alan Dulles, before he went to Bern, I believe, was part of that planning. Some of what they planned, and by the way, this was Joint Council on Foreign Relations and State Department. It's hard to say whether it was public or private. It was a mix. It was very definitely a deep state planning for the post-war, and It was planning for the kind of things you mentioned, including, I believe, the CIA. I can't prove that, but then one of the studies, War Peace Studies, is still classified. It's now 75 years later, 70 years later. So you feel it must be pretty sensitive, and I think it was. The idea of the CIA, I think I prove in my book, is an idea that came out of Wall Street and was imposed on Truman, who didn't want it, and who in stage one thought he had prevented it from happening when he shut down OSS, which was the wartime predecessor.
I think that's the key, is Wall Street, when you're talking about the modern origins of the deep state and in the final years of World War II and the post-war years, because they were key Wall Street firms, law firms like Sullivan and Cromwell, where the Dulles brothers reigned, and key figures like Wild Bill Donovan, who ran the OSS, Frank Wisner, who became a key colleague and ally of Alan Dulles and the CIA, and in the sort of transitional stage.
Don't forget Forrestal.
And James Forrestal, the Secretary of Defense. These were all investment bankers, Wall Street lawyers, who shared the same very aggressive vision of America's place in the world. And they really developed that consensus, as Peter said, in organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations and others. In some ways, it's a very, although Peter doesn't like to use the word, the secret team and all that, and I agree with him on that, it is more structural than that and systemic than that. But there are these key figures and these key organizations in which that sort of policy cohered.
There are structures in the system. Definitely.
And strategy, exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think even things like events like the overthrow of the Arbenz government, the democratic government in Guatemala, those came out of study groups of the Council on Foreign Relations. Right. You have to have a mechanism for these people to, to debate, to consider, international events. And they were brilliant about creating those kind of mechanisms. And then first in the private sector, in Wall Street, in these organizations, and then taking their ideas to Washington.
Also, to come back to the oil companies, most people remember the overthrow of Mossadegh in 1953 as a CIA operation, and in a sense it was. But what happened there was that the CIA took on an operation that had begun by the oil companies and the British. And under Truman, Churchill had asked Truman to do this, and Truman refused. And instead, he sent Harriman. He sent someone to Tehran to see if they couldn't work out a deal very like what was now happening in Saudi Arabia, where the host country and the oil company split the profits 50-50. And Iran was willing to do it, but the Anglo-Iranian oil company refused because they didn't want to give up so much of their profits. And then when the oil companies put a huge amount of money into the 1952 election to elect Eisenhower, and remember, Eisenhower doesn't become president until January of 51, but almost 53, sorry. But already in November of 52, the CIA is starting to prepare for TP Ajax, the operation which overthrew Mossadegh, even though the president is still Truman, who had forbidden it, and the president who's going to authorize it hasn't taken power yet. So that is, I think, how the CIA is like a functioning arm of the deep state, and in this case, the oil companies. Yes, in a sense,
and
it was...
And Truman was appalled, as the gentleman was suggesting, at what happened to the CIA,
right,
an agency that he created. He did see it more as an agency that would gather intelligence and sort of process it for the White House,
exactly,
not as a rogue outfit that was going around overthrowing governments all around the world.
And he said so right after the Kennedy assassination, which was an
very tellingly.
And, of course, the media sort of trashed him for it. They don't know it was all set up in 1947. It wasn't. It was all done through OPC, which was Frank Wisner's little new arm, staffed at the top level almost exclusively with Wall Street.
So to me, Peter, some of the most interesting moments in American history are when the deep state comes in conflict with our Democratic government, with certain presidents who do stand up to them, to an extent Truman, although he, I think, also enabled the national security state to a great degree, but even more so President Kennedy, with fatal results for Kennedy. And that story, I think, has not still been fully told, although we will do our best in this next book about Alan Dulles. But that is the moment when everything hangs in the balance for us as a nation. Is the Democratic government that we've elected going to prevail, or are these forces that are much less accountable and much more aggressive? And generally, of course, unfortunately, it is the deep state that prevails.
And what I'm saying in my book is that in this period, 1960 to 1980, there was a real struggle between what you might call the covert side, the deep state, and the public state, Church Committee, poor Stansfield Turner, and so on. And since the election of Reagan, there isn't that struggle anymore because the deep state is secure at the heart of the public state. And that is a huge change in this country, which accounts for so many other things.
Well, I want to thank you all for being here tonight and thank the Green Arcade once again for staging this event. Thank you, Patrick Marks. And of course, I want to thank Peter Dale Scott for his lifetime of work. And I will agree with what someone else said here. Peter says he's not a hero. He's intellectually been incredibly intrepid, and we owe him a lot for what he's produced over the last many years, Peter.
Thank you all, everybody. Thank you. Thank you.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
And that concludes the Project Censored show for this week. We've just heard a conversation between authors Peter Dale Scott and David Talbot, recorded February 11th in San Francisco. We'd like to thank Ken Jenkins for recording that event. Thanks also to our producer Anthony Fest and our engineer Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show is heard on nearly 24 radio stations around the United States. To hear this program again or listen to previous programs, visit our website, projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We'll see you next time.
Created by criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, of the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, hypnotized by the master thief, divine conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu.